now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Sometimes you have to wait. In mid-July, the Obama administration finally released a redacted version of the controversial 28 pages from the 2002 intelligence investigation. That investigation was chaired by Florida's former Senator Bob Graham. And after the report came out, I requested an interview with the senator, and they called back yesterday here in the middle of September, and today I was able to spend half an hour talking to Senator Graham. I think you'll find it fascinating, his conversation, his comments about why the Bush and Obama administrations tried to avoid releasing these documents, whether the remaining redactions are significant, and the role that Saudi Arabia likely played in the events of 9/11. We'll get into some of the details and take a look at the big picture, too. Senator Bob Graham coming up in just a moment. But first, let me thank the people who support my work at this podcast with your subscriptions. People like Andy Krieger. I had a great email from him a couple of days ago. Bill Goodacre. And, let's see, I have to go to a different page here. Jeff Lipinski, Faith Peoples. They're just some of the people who support my work. I invite you to join them. You go to peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber, takes you to the sign-up page, and it's as easy as P-I-E. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Senator Bob Graham returns to the Peter B. Collins Podcast today. He served on the Senate Intelligence Committee and rose to chair that committee, and he presided over the Joint Intelligence Investigation in 2002 into the events of September 11th, 2001. Senator Graham, it's great to talk to you again.
Peter, thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to talk with you and your listeners again.
Well, and thank you for your persistence. Only took 14 years to get the information that you helped produce, released with slight redactions for the American public to review. Tell me, I want to ask you what we've learned from the so-called 28 pages, but first, let me ask you, a seasoned Washington insider, what did you learn from the efforts to avoid disclosure and the many moves that were made to block your efforts to bring these documents to daylight?
I learned that the people who were saying that the 28 pages were irrelevant, superficial, premature, unvetted, were not speaking with candor. If they had been all of those things, why for 13 years would they have been withheld so assiduously from the public? I think, in fact, what the 28 pages did was, first, they provided important information about the relationship between key officials in the Saudi government and other Saudi institutions, such as charities, and the 19 hijackers, as well as the Al-Qaeda organization. Probably the most surprising information was the relationship between the Saudi ambassador to the United States this time, Prince Bandar, where it was disclosed that in the phone book of Abu Zubaydah, one of bin Laden's closest associates, was the unlisted telephone number for the firm that manages Prince Bandar's home in Aspen and his bodyguard in Washington.
Now, Senator,
the question,
Senator, forgive me. I do want to get into the meat of those issues, but I still want to focus for a minute here on all of the efforts to thwart your desire to see these documents disclosed, including the hazing that you received, I believe it was at Dulles Airport, when you were traveling into Washington one day, and they pulled you aside and gave you a little talk.
Well, I think there were a number of motivations for what was done. Some of them were incompetence, that institutions, governmental agencies had acted in ways that clearly did not achieve the level of either professional or ethical standards that we would expect of a government organization. I think another part was the concern about upsetting the Saudis, making them less amenable to the United States if we made this information about their activities publicly available. There were a range of possible reasons, but the practical effect was that we made some serious mistakes because the 28 pages were not made available when they should have been, which would have been in the summer of 2003, at least, if not in the winter of 2002.
Mm-hmm.
We might have avoided the Iraq War. The Iraq War was in part based on the fact that Iraq allegedly had assisted bin Laden in carrying out 9/11. If the 28 pages had been made public, the public would have known it wasn't Iraq. It was Saudi Arabia that had assisted the hijackers, and possibly we would not have gone to war, at least wouldn't have gone to war with the wrong country.
And Senator, I can certainly understand, while not endorsing, I can understand the motives of the Bush administration to suppress the 28 pages. They, of course, kept a very tight rein, so to speak, on the 9/11 commission that followed your work. But if we start with 2009 and the presidency of Barack Obama, he promised Kristen Breitweiser and Lori Van Auken that he would make sure these documents were released, and it took him 7 years. So what slow-walked the release during the Obama administration?
Well, that's a much more difficult question because the motives of the Bush administration were fairly obvious. The motivations for Obama, more obscure. Retreat to the suggestion that it was the desire to avoid upsetting the Saudis. We've gotten a little window on that from a surprising development, and that is the recognition that there was another choice available to the U.S. government throughout the 15 years since 9/11, another choice than what is hopefully going to happen, which is that the victims' families will litigate in a U.S. court whether the Saudis were involved, and if so, what compensation they should pay.
Mm-hmm.
The alternative would have been for the U.S. government diplomatically to have gone to Saudi Arabia and said, here's the evidence that we have that you were involved in 9/11. Let's sit down at the table and start talking about what was the extent of your role and what kind of compensation should you pay. That's exactly what happened back after the 1988 explosion over Lockerbie, Scotland, of a Pan Am flight,
mm-hmm.
Flight 103. And after a period of denial, finally Gaddafi admitted that they had been involved and paid $10 million to each of the 270 victims' families. That approach was rejected first by the Bush administration and then by the Obama administration, out of a feeling that it would be embarrassing to the Saudis even to suggest that they should sit at a conference table and discuss the evidence that indicated that they might possibly be involved.
Mm-hmm. And Senator, as you look at this presently, we're talking on September 20th, and the Senate is about to act on JASTA, the bill you just referred to, that would allow the survivors of 9/11 victims to sue Saudi Arabia using the courts as a method to expose the truth instead of a congressional inquiry or some objective independent panel. And the president is threatening to veto that. He appears to be jockeying, depending on when the Senate will actually recess. And he has reportedly hoped to flip some Republican senators who voted for JASTA last April into sustaining his veto once he presumably issues that. How do you see this playing out? And do you think that JASTA will become law?
I certainly hope that it will become law. It should become law. If the U.S. government has made the conscious decision that we will not pursue the interest of U.S. citizens, 3,000 killed, murdered on September the 11th through diplomacy and state-to-state negotiation, it, in my opinion, it is unconscionably unfair to then deny the same Americans the right to use their court system as a means of determining responsibility and compensation. The president has had the bill, which passed unanimously out of both the House and the Senate, that very rarely happens in this partisan Congress, and the president has had the bill now for 4 or 5 days, and he has a total of 10 days to decide whether he will sign it or veto it. I strongly hope that he will sign this bill and let the courts be a forum in which we will learn more about what happened on that fateful day and the days leading up to it. And if a jury determines that there was enough evidence to hold Saudi Arabia responsible, there will be some compensation to those who have already borne so much of the pain of 9/11.
Senator, I think I understand and have some appreciation for the importance and sensitivity of our alliance with Saudi Arabia. At the same time, the appearance here is pretty clear that they enjoy a special status, that they are above not only American law, but that investigations into substantive issues related to their potential involvement in 9/11 can be stymied simply with a claim of national security, or we don't want to rock the boat. The Saudis might sell, you know, $1 trillion worth of our T-bills and crater our economy. These are all threats. You know, there are many threats. But fundamentally, if we're a nation that stands for the rule of law, no nation, no person should be above the law.
Peter, I wish I could say it as well as you have just articulated. I think it's an outrage that the United States is allowing this country, which essentially is a medieval monarchy, to exercise such sway over important issues to the United States, including the fact that Saudi Arabia is the heartland of the Wahhabist version of Islam. And as that, it has been training and preparing young, particularly Sunni males, in mosques and madrasas to believe in jihad, reject tolerance, and become the next generation of terrorists. I think it's just an outrage what we're doing, and we ought to start acting as the proud country that we are, with our first responsibility being to the safety and security of the people of the United States.
Senator Richard Clark, who served both the Clinton and Bush administrations as the White House advisor or czar on terrorism, after the release of the partly redacted 28, 29 pages, he published some comments, and I'm looking at them now. He focuses on the CIA tracking of two of the alleged hijackers, Al Midhar and Al Hamzi, from Malaysia to Thailand to Los Angeles. And he cites the 2002 report and the CIA inspector general that some 50 to 60 people at CIA were aware that the men were in the country but didn't notify the FBI as they should have. Now, we know that the 9/11 Commission made an elaborate drama out of connecting the dots, but this doesn't seem to be accidental or, some kind of an oversight. And I'd like to know your reaction to Clark's comments.
I think they are essentially correct. They are correct. And that was just one of a dozen instances in which 9/11 could have been aborted before September the 11th, and in which issues of failure of agencies, particularly the FBI and the CIA, to share what they knew was a major factor in those dozen instances that could have avoided that terrible day. I agree that that was one of the pieces of hard evidence that was solidified through the 28 pages.
Mm-hmm. And Senator Clark additionally suspects that the CIA might have used Saudi intelligence to track the suspects and try to flip them to becoming double agents or at least informing for the United States. But we could just as easily infer that CIA was using Saudi intelligence to manage these two operatives. I know this gets into a kind of hall of mirrors of who did what to whom and where it all started, but there are these interlocking issues that raise these significant questions.
I'm aware that Dick Clark has made this suggestion that maybe there was a whole additional layer to 9/11 that federal U.S. agencies were trying to engage the hijackers. And that's why they were being so solicitous of them. And the engagement was in hopes that they would assist us in finding other plots and other individuals who might be at risk. I have spent a lot of the last 15 years involved in the details of 9/11. I have never seen any hard evidence to support that theory. I respect Dick, and I hope if he has such evidence that he'll make it available. I am a very strong believer in transparency, and I think that's been another victim of 9/11. It has reinforced the tendency of the government to hide, suppress, keep from the public information that they deserve to see.
And, Senator, I respect that you are very careful with your words, and you try not to engage in excessive speculation, and I do appreciate that. But fundamentally, you would not object to an objective investigation into Clark's allegation that there may have been this reverse role where the CIA was using the Saudis.
Yes, several years ago, I started calling for a new 9/11 investigation using information that's available today that wasn't available at the time the congressional inquiry or the Citizens 9/11 Commission were doing their reviews. And I think this would be a perfectly appropriate issue for that new review of 9/11 to take into consideration and maybe run it to ground, find whether there is substantiation for it.
I want to now dive into some of the specifics in the 28 pages, Senator. And first of all, there still is limited redaction. Since you presumably read the original document, Are these redactions trivial, or do you support the final redacted version that was released?
There were approximately 11% of the words in the 28 pages which were redacted before they were released on the 15th of July. I would be exaggerating the strength of my memory to be able to represent that something that I read in the fall of 2002, which is when those pages were being prepared, mm-hmm. that I can remember them to the level of detail of being able to look behind the dark slashes across the 28 pages that represent the redactions. There are the members of Congress have had the right to access to the 28 pages in their original form. There's been some suggestion that some member of Congress should go into that classified room with a copy of the version that was made public and access to a copy of the original and try to answer the question that you just asked. Were these redactions significant? Did they fundamentally change the narrative of what happened on 9/11? Did they alter the sense of who was responsible? Were they trivial?
Mm-hmm.
I tend to think it's more likely they were taking out more than one out of every 10 words. It's hard not for it to have had some impact on altering or reducing the meaning uh-huh. of the document that was made public.
And do you still hold a security clearance, Senator?
No, I had one, of course, while I was on the Intelligence Committee, and then I served as chair of the Commission on Weapons of Mass Destruction, and I had a security clearance then, and then later I was on the CIA's External Advisory Board with a security clearance. But since Leon Panetta left the CIA, which I think was about in 2012 or 13, I have not had a security clearance.
All right, so you can't go back and look at these things even with a minder?
Yeah, no.
Okay.
No.
I know you're not a Sandy Berger. I wouldn't suggest that in any way, Senator. Let's talk about some of the individuals named. Fahad al-Tumeri, Saudi consular official in Los Angeles. And he was allowed to leave the country, and to my knowledge, has never been interrogated by our government or the FBI. There was some, I see here in a New York Times article, an FBI document from 2012 concluded that Tumeri immediately assigned an individual to take care of Al-Hamzi and Al-Midhar during their time in Los Angeles. But the FBI has been unable to piece together other details of the movement of the two men during their early days in the United States. Can you tell us anything more about al-Tumeri?
Well, Tumeri was the head of the religious department within the consulate of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in Los Angeles. He also was an imam at a church in Los Angeles, which had been financed, a mosque that had been financed by the Saudi government. Prior to the two future hijackers who were living in Los Angeles, meeting with the man who became their mentor during their subsequent stay in San Diego, his name was Al Bayoumi.
Mm-hmm.
Tumeri had had a long discussion in his office at the Los Angeles consulate with Bayoumi. There's been a strong inferences that it was at that meeting that Tumeri gave Bayoumi his marching orders as to what he was to do relative to the two hijackers that had just arrived in the United States, and arranged for Bayoumi and the two hijackers to have what was called a, quote, coincidental meeting at a restaurant in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a very key figure in this, and as you said, has not been as thoroughly interrogated as he should have been, given the amount of information that he could have provided on the earliest days of the hijackers assembling it first in California and then elsewhere in the country to carry out 9/11.
Senator, regarding al-Bayoumi, I find this new information to me, anyway, from the 28 pages. According to FBI files, a name is redacted, at the company, and the company they're referring to is affiliated with the Saudi Ministry of Defense and Aviation. They say that al-Bayoumi received a monthly salary even though he had only been there on one occasion, so he's got a paycheck for a no-show job. The support increased substantially in April 2000, 2 months after the hijackers arrived in San Diego, decreased slightly in December of 2000, and stayed at the same level until August of 2001. Now, this is a very important stream of money that supported the hijackers in San Diego as they reportedly went to flight schools. And we have the allegations of money that was channeled by Prince Bandar's wife that also reached the hijackers to provide for their support. This really seems to be a very significant investigative lead that was not just ignored, but they intentionally refused to follow up on it.
Well, we're going to learn some more about that, I hope, shortly. The after the Congressional Joint Inquiry concluded its work, the 28 pages were in part an outline of investigations that the Congress had started but had not come to a conclusion at the time that we had to submit our report. We were authorized by that session of Congress, and our charter ran out the first week in January of 2003. So we handed off a number of leads, including the one you've just mentioned, to the Citizens 9/11 Commission. That commission's papers are in the National Archives. We are about to start an effort to get the National Archives to identify within the trove of documents that it now has in its possession those that relate to the follow-up investigation of trails started by the congressional investigation, a key one being this issue of where did the hijackers in San Diego get their financing. I hope that within a reasonable period of time that we'll have access to find out, was there a follow-up investigation on the financing that was available either through this aviation company, which Bayoumi had a ghost job, he got paid but never showed up to work, or through the wife, and at least in one instance, the Saudi ambassador himself funding the hijackers living in San Diego. My principal interest today is, one, to try to urge the president not to veto the JASTA bill,
mm-hmm.
and two, to urge the president to use his authority to begin releasing information which remains suppressed so that the American people can make decisions on 9/11 and what those decisions mean for actions today based on as much information as possible.
Senator, the 28 pages tick off a series of bullet points about al-Bayoumi, and just suffice it to say he had strong long-term ties to various elements of the Saudi government. And then a character I had not seen before, Osama Basnan, surfaces here as essentially the conduit for the money that came from Bandar's wife, Haifa, and was laundered through to support the alleged hijackers, somewhere to the tune of $74,000, perhaps more.
Yeah, there is. This is not all a black and white story. There are mixtures. The Basnan had been in the United States since at least the early 1990s. He had been an associate of the man that is referred to as the blind sheikh, who was the one who, in 1993, tried to blow up the World Trade Center. He was a Saudi and subsequently became Bayoumi's assistant. Bayoumi's, what his real job, as opposed to the fake job that he had with the aviation company was to monitor Saudi students who were studying at colleges and universities in Southern California. He was part of a large network that the Saudis established after the first Persian Gulf War to assure themselves that there weren't young Saudis plotting against the kingdom's survival in the same way that there had been young people who successfully plotted against the Shah of Iran in 1979.
Mm-hmm.
And that network, in my opinion, and this is speculation, I think we'll learn that my speculation was accurate, that this network of monitors of students took on a secondary job, which was to also become the facilitators for the hijackers who had come into the United States. That certainly was what Bayoumi had taken on that second job. Basnan was sort of monitoring Bayoumi, following Bayoumi, and when Bayoumi left the country shortly before 9/11, Basnan took over both the job of monitoring students and the job of facilitating the hijackers who still remained in Southern California.
Senator Graham, I don't want to push our time limits here too much. I respect that you have other things to do, and I really appreciate you being generous enough to spend time with me today. Is there anything else in the 28 pages that I haven't touched on that you'd like to alert listeners to so they might look it up and research it themselves?
In my opinion, the most important things now are those trails that were first laid in the 28 pages, such as just what was the role of Prince Bandar, both in supporting al-Qaeda as an institution and assisting the 19 hijackers as operatives of al-Qaeda. We will find out the answer to those questions when we get access to the follow-up investigations that were done by the 9/11 Commission, and in some instances also by either the FBI and or the CIA. And I hope we don't have to wait 13 years to get that follow-up information.
Indeed. And here's a double if question, Senator. If JASTA is not vetoed and becomes law, and if lawsuits do produce investigations into the Saudi role, would you serve as a consultant or a contributor to that effort?
Well, I have gotten to know the attorneys who will be representing the victims if they're able to have their day in court. They are excellent, experienced, have worked in, there's nothing that is analogous to 9/11, but they have had enough experience around the edges do I think bore deeply into the evidence that's available, present it truthfully and effectively to a jury, and then the jury will make the decision as to the responsibility of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for 9/11.
Senator, you're a little older than I am, and I won't ask your age, but I'm 63. Will I learn the truth of 9/11 in my lifetime?
Well, I'm 79, and I'm certainly hoping that I'm going to learn it in my lifetime. I hope that you not only will learn it, but have an opportunity to see that the results of using this information are manifest in the highest standards of America's commitment to rule of law and justice.
And my final question, Senator, do you have any regrets that you ever joined the intelligence community and got briefed into the black world?
No, this has been a very significant, important part of my life. I've learned a lot, and I hope have made a contribution to other people's understanding of this by encouraging the maximum amount of openness and access by the American people to the information that their government has gathered and for now almost 15 years kept from them.
Well, Senator, keep fighting for the truth. You have my support with no limitation, and I thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Peter. Best wishes.
Senator Graham remains excessively polite and diplomatic, but I salute the courage and persistence he's shown in fighting to bring us the truth.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.